nature of apocalyptic literature. You said one of the identifiers is that the writer would use a pseudonym, kind of like they're doing Enoch.
Right.
But you say, in your notes, you say, not the case with Revelations, Daniel, and others. Is that just because those are canon books and we're saying, nah? Or
it's not consistent, but it seems like the biblical books don't use the pseudonym.
Right, like in First Enoch, the writer claims he's Enoch. Well, he's clearly not. In the book of Revelation, the writer claims he's John, which he clearly is.
So there's differences. It's not across the board.
Daniel's a little different, though, right? Because Daniel's not as clear.
Well, no, the writer is Daniel, and the person seeing the vision is Daniel, and it really is.
Wasn't Daniel written closer to the...
No, that is not true. Pick up a copy of my book on Daniel. That is.
John is very strong.
That's a completely untenable view that it only came because of atheists. Yeah, there's no way.
You can't find a scholar that can't say that, though.
I know, but they're all wrong. They're all completely, utterly wrong.
You can't find a single scholar that will say.
No, I've seen people within our church bow to that idea, but the evidence completely destroys that view. Yeah.
I don't want to detract those views.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so basically what they're saying is that Daniel is a fake book. It's a fake author, which that would be a problem. But the thing is, if the evidence agreed with that, then I guess we'd have to accept it. But the evidence doesn't agree with it at all. For example, they'll say, well, there's Greek words in there, which means it happened after the Greek times. All right, fine. So what do you think they call a piano in China?
Piano.
They call it a piano. In other words, the only Greek words in Daniel are for musical instruments. Those are the only Greek words, which is evidence for only very, very slight Greek influence. They'll say the Aramaic is from... the second century BC, but it's just flat out not true. Any Aramaic scholar, not these people, but any Aramaic scholar who studies will tell you that the Aramaic is from the fourth or fifth century and it's Eastern, not Western Aramaic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the only reason they came up with that theory anyway is because they don't like the fact that Daniel prophesies the future.
Right. So,
but the problem is in Daniel 7 is a prophecy of Domitian. And Domitian is well after, and we have Dead Sea Scrolls of Daniel. In fact, we have a Dead Sea Scroll of Daniel from 125 BC. In other words, Daniel in 125 BC was already accepted as an inspired canonical book. So the idea is these Jewish people, within 30 years, supposedly of it being written, were duped into thinking that Daniel wrote it anyway. Don't get me started on that. Don't get me started on that. All right. So, great. So I'm going to do just 3 minutes, just giving my view on what Glenn was talking about, and then I'll just get right into it here. So, again, speaking of recapitulation, I'm going to just very, very briefly kind of give my version of the same thing. The theme of Revelation is this. Peel back the layers of history and even the terrible persecutions that were going on around the Christians at that time. And what do we have? The Lamb is on the throne and God is in control. That's the picture. All right. And if we lose that picture by looking at the white horse, the red horse, the pale yellow horse and all that sort of stuff, that we need to not do that. By the way, we're on, right? Great. My phone is making noises, so I need to make it stop making noises. Thank you. All right, great. The message of Revelation is be encouraged and faithful to Jesus Christ. Jesus is Lord, not Caesar. And like Glenn mentioned, the objective is for us to be comforted. Not comfortable. Revelation is not going to make you feel comfortable, not even a little bit. But the intention is that you would feel comforted in that God is in control. So description of Revelation is a divine picture book. It's like a spiritual comic book, except not funny. A graphic novel representing the historical development of the early Christian church. All right, and I agree with Glenn completely that although the audience, the emphasis on Revelation is the church right then and there, right in the first century, in the second century, that no doubt about it, it's a picture that it completely, utterly applies to us, even if the specific situation of the kinds of persecution they were experiencing was different. The idea, everything that Revelation is about, completely, totally applies to us. All right? So the purpose of Revelation then is to show in dramatic fashion that God is in control. Romans appeals to the intellect. Psalms appeals to the emotions. And Revelation appeals to the imagination. You need to let your imagination go with it. It's a picture. And as you let your imagination kind of go with it, and then you pull back from that imagination, and you think, all right, how does that apply to my life? All right, so it's about how God deals with mankind in all ages, although the context of it is how God is dealing with mankind in the late first and early second century. So Revelation is a description of how things happen again and again. And everything that's going on is being repeated, and there's that recapitulation idea. So there's multiple fulfillments, although to take it out of its original context is a big mistake, which of course is what the premillennialists do. All right, so here's our outline. We've already seen it. Great. Now, I'm doing a lesson, and in this lesson, I'm not going to use the book of Revelation at all. At all. Purposely not. So what we want to do is we want to get the idea and the feel that when we're reading Revelation, it's like the Old Testament. And it is amazing to me that the number of references, the number of allusions, and the precision, mathematical precision, how John does it, it is totally blowing away. But the thing is, you have to know what he's referring back to. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at some of the passages that are being alluded to, but we're going to read those passages in their context. And we're going to kind of anticipate how John is going to use them in the book of Revelation. So point number one that I want to make is if you want to understand how Revelation fits in the Bible, think of Daniel and Revelation as being virtually the exact same thing.
And by the way, it is Revelation, not Revelations.
Right. Don't give me, yeah, not Revelations. And by the way, it's not Psalms 50. It's Psalm 50. Right? It's not Psalm 87. Right? It's not Psalms 87. It's Psalm 87. Yes. Revelation, it's in the singular. It bothers people like Len and I. For you, it probably doesn't matter, and that's okay. But it probably will bother you after this class. Okay, so the place of Daniel in the Old Testament occupies nearly the identical place of Revelation in the New Testament. And you could argue that Revelation is Daniel part two. In fact, Daniel ends by saying, all right, we're going to seal the scroll. And then when you get to Revelation chapter 6, then you open the scroll. Now, how precisely we want to interpret that way is probably debatable. So both Daniel and Revelation are largely apocalyptic. They both have concerns of the end times. How many times does the Old Testament talk about the final resurrection of all people and then judgment and then the final state of mankind? Just Daniel. If you took Daniel 12 out of the Old Testament, you'd have some explaining to do. All right? Both are written to a people who are suffering very, very intense persecution. In the case of Daniel, the audience is the Jews suffering extreme persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes. in the period of 167 to 164 BC. And the message to the Jews experiencing these extreme persecutions, 400 years after Daniel wrote about it, is God is in control. It's a message of comfort. It's going to be tough. There's going to be great tribulation. You'll suffer and many of you will die. But either way, God is in control. And that's really exactly what's going on in the book of Revelation. All right, so in the case of Revelation, of course, it's the immediate context is the persecution in the time of Domitian. But I would argue really the context is the persecutions in the first through early fourth century. All right, so I'm pretty sure those who are suffering under Diocletian would apply Revelation to themselves almost equally to the late first century persecutions. And by the way, the persecutions in the third and fourth century are far more intense and broad than that of Domitian. All right, so let's read Daniel 8:26. Daniel 8:26. It says, the vision of the evenings and mornings that have been given to you is true, but seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future. All right? So Daniel's saying these prophecies concern things in the distant future. And then Daniel 12, verse 4, which I think is sort of a transitional verse, so you could connect Daniel with Revelation. It says, but you, Daniel, roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. And what is the time of the end? We're living in the time of the end, right? We are living in the last days. All right, and then when you read Revelation 1:1, which we'll do in our next lesson, we're going to see these visions concern things which will soon take place. So Daniel says these are things in regarding the distant future. Well, how distant? Well, we can count the years. All right, because Daniel 8 was written in roughly 550-something B.C., and the fulfillment of it is just under 600 years later, roughly. All right, so that's the distant future. So when John says this is about something that will soon take place, if you say it's 2,000 years from now, that doesn't seem to really work super, super well, I would say. Probably not. All right? And even another thing about, there's a fairly significant difference between Daniel and Revelation in this, because in Daniel you have actual things happening. You have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego dealing with the big statue there. And then you have Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in chapter 1, basically being asked to compromise, etc. And then you have in Daniel 6, where Daniel's being asked to stop praying and all that kind of stuff. So what's happening here is the present culture, they're being extremely tempted to compromise with the present culture, yeah. And the idea is don't do it. Now, Revelation does that in a different way. So you have the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the land, and so Revelation, sort of 12 through 15, where you have these visions of, and basically what's happening is they're being tempted to compromise with the world, kind of like Glenn said. So even in that part, which it seems to be very different, where Daniel's dealing with actual things that are actually happening and it's historical, and Revelation's using it in visionary ways. Even in that case, it's about the same thing, which is, hey, the culture around you is trying to get you to become like them. Messages, don't do it. Okay? Good. Now let's talk about, we talked about the place of Daniel and the relationship between Daniel and Revelation, and you could argue that Revelation is Daniel part two. The message, the focus, I mean, there's so many parallels there. On the other hand, you can think of as Revelation is the completion of the book of Genesis. And Genesis and Revelation have been called bookends of the Bible. And I think that is a pretty decent picture as well. And, of course, it just so happens Genesis is the beginning and Revelation is the end. And it's not an accident, I think, that John says, anybody who adds to this book, they're in deep doo-doo. They're in big trouble here, right? Because with Revelation, the canonical, of course, New Testament ends. All right, so let's do this. Let me cover the whole Bible. This is the Reader's Digest Condensed Version. Of course, you all don't know what a Reader's Digest Condensed Version is, but Glenn knows what it is. Okay, and we have somebody else old enough to remember that. So they, in fact, Reader's Digest actually put out a condensed version of the Bible. So what they would do is they would take a novel, say a 500-page novel, and they'd do a 20-page version and put it in, all right? And they actually did a condensed version of the Bible, and they took the part in Revelation about don't take any words out of this book. They didn't include that in their condensed version. All right. But anyway, this is my condensed version of the Bible. Genesis chapter 1. God created everything, and it was good. Genesis chapter 2. God created us so that we could love Him, we could be loved by Him, and we could be loved, and we could love one another. Genesis 3 through 12, we blew it totally. We lost our place in the garden. We lost the intimate relationship that God had in mind for us. The rest of Genesis through Revelation 20, God is fixing the problem. Revelation 21 and 22, God fixed the problem when we're back in the garden. So the Bible starts in the garden, and it ends in the garden. And when we get to Revelation 21, we'll see the imagery in Revelation 21 comes completely from Genesis chapter 2. So in that sense, then, we could think of Genesis as being the beginning and a Revelation being the completion of the biblical story. Okay? So it's all about us being kicked out of the garden and then God devising a plan. The plan was to choose a man. His name was Abraham. And through Abraham to create a people and a nation. And He gave them a place. And He gave them a law. And He sent them prophets, all of which was telescoping, if you will, to the plan, which was to send Jesus to solve the problem. All right, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you some imagery, some foreshadowing. So some of the themes of Revelation are going to be the garden, okay, protection, throne, and judgment. And again, you want to get the picture. You want to see the forest, not the trees. So here's the forest. I'm going to go through these. The forest is the garden. What picture do you get from the garden? And then protection. Okay? And then the throne room. And judgment, not in any particular order. Because it starts with the garden and it ends in the garden, correct? So let's look at some garden imagery. The one I don't really need to read is Genesis chapter 2. So I'm going to assume that you all get the picture. We don't need to read it. The picture of rivers and fruit and the tree. The tree of life. And by the way, that tree shows up again in where? In Revelation chapter 21, the same tree. But the garden imagery is found often in the Old Testament. And the idea is, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read these Old Testament passages, and I want you to get the picture and then hold that picture because we're going to come back to that picture repeatedly. So Ezekiel 36, 33 through 36. Ezekiel 36, all right, verse 33. So this is a foreshadow. Okay? This is what the Sovereign Lord says. On the day I cleanse you from all your sins, I will resettle your towns, and the ruins will be rebuilt. The desolate land will be cultivated instead of lying desolate in the sight of all who pass through it. They will say, this land that was laid waste has become like the Garden of Eden. The cities that were lying in ruins, desolate and destroyed, are now fortified and inhabited. Then the nations around you that remain will know that I, the Lord, have rebuilt what was destroyed and have replanted what was desolate. Now, is he talking about the return of Israel to the promised land? Is he talking about that? Is he talking about the return of Judah after the Babylonian captivity during the Persian time? Is he talking about that? Yes. Is he talking about the church? Yes. Is he talking about end times? Is he talking about our return to the garden for eternity? Yes. All three. So the imagery. Okay? Ezekiel 37, 26 and 27. By the way, if you could read the context around these, and you'll see he's talking about all three. Ezekiel 37, 26 and 27. Here we go. It says, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant. I will establish them and increase their numbers, and I will put my sanctuary among them forever. My dwelling place will be with them. I will be their God, and they will be my people. Then the nations will know that I, the Lord, make Israel holy when my sanctuary is among them forever. Is he talking about the church? Absolutely. Is he talking about Revelation 21 and 22? Absolutely. I love Ezekiel, by the way. I keep coming back to Ezekiel. And then there's Ezekiel 47. This is one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible. And again, remember, this is garden imagery. Okay? By the way, there's not a lot of garden imagery in Revelation as a whole, okay? No, it's just at the end, okay? All right, the man brought me back to the entrance of the temple. It's always the temple. It's the sanctuary, the tabernacle. I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east. The water was coming down from under the south side of the temple, south of the altar. He brought me out through the north gate, and he led me around the outside to the outer gate facing east, and the water was trickling from the south side. And as the man went eastward with a measuring line in his hand, he measured off 1,000 cubits and led me through water that was ankle deep. He measured off another 1,000 cubits, and he led me through water that was knee deep. He measured off another 1,000, and he led me through water that was up to the waist. He's talking about the Holy Spirit, by the way. He measured off another 1,000, but now it was a river that I could not cross because the water had risen and it was deep enough to swim in, a river that no one could cross. And he asked me, son of man, do you see this? By the way, if an angel ever asks you, do you see this? The thing to say is, yes, I see it. That's always the answer to give. Then he led me back to the bank of the river. When I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. He said to me, this water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah, which is the Dead Sea. Has anybody been at the Dead Sea? It's dead. All right? When it empties into the sea, the salty water there becomes fresh. Swarms of living creatures which will live wherever the river flows. There'll be a large number of fish because this water flows there and makes the salt water fresh. So where the river flows, everything will live. What about Zechariah 14, 8 through 11? Zechariah 14, 8 through 11. Another vision of end times. It says, on that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half of it east of the Dead Sea and half of it west of the Mediterranean Sea. So now we have a clear evidence of a contradiction in the Bible, because in Ezekiel it says it all goes to the Dead Sea, and in Zechariah it says half goes to the Dead Sea, half goes to the Mediterranean Sea. Ha, 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 that's not a, you know. This is apocalyptic stuff, right? Anyway, the Lord will be king over the whole earth. On that day, there will be one Lord, and his name the only name. I guess that's not talking about the church age. I think that's just talking about end times. The whole land from Geba to Rimmon, south to Jerusalem, will become like the Arabah. But Jerusalem will be raised up on high from the Benjamin gate to the first gate to the corner gate to the Tower of Hananel to the royal wine presses. All will remain in its place. It will be inhabited. Never again will it be destroyed. Jerusalem will be secure. All right, so again, that's the imagery. And we're going to come back to that in Revelation. All right, what about protection? Okay, there's the imagery of protection. That's an important one. Let's go to Zechariah 2, verse 1 through 5. I guess it's not in the PowerPoint, but it's in the Bible, so we're going to read it. Zechariah 2, 1 through 5. And we are going to see the idea of protection. That's going to be a continual, recurrent theme. There's going to be total chaos going on. God's going to be picking people off. And even some in the church are going to get picked off. And yet God is going to measure the inner courts of the temple. And measurement always refers to protection, I think, as far as I know. Okay? Then I looked up, and there before me was a man with a measuring line in his hand. I asked, "Where are you going?" He answered me, "To measure Jerusalem, to find out how wide and long it is." Well, the angel who was speaking to me was leaving. Another angel came to meet him, and he said to him, "Run, tell the young man, Jerusalem will be a city without walls because of the great number of people and animals in it." By the way, why do you need walls? For protection against enemies. It says Jerusalem is going to be a place without walls. Now, wait a minute. Aren't there really thick walls in Revelation 21? What do those really thick walls in Revelation 21 mean? Starts with a P. Protection. So are they literal? No. Besides, the gates never close. So what good is a wall if you never close the gate, right? So you got to get the picture. You got to get the picture. And I myself will be a wall of fire. See, you got to get that picture. See, God is a wall of fire around the church. Does that mean nobody will get picked off? No, it is not what it means. Will there be a day when nobody gets picked off anymore? Absolutely. All right, and then there's Gog and Magog. All right, everybody's favorite passage, Gog and Magog, which nobody gets. They're totally confusing. All right, I found this on the internet. There you go. Here's the wall. There's the wall. Here's Gog and Magog, and here we are, and here's that wall. And what's that wall going to be? It's going to be God protection. Very good. It's going to be God. All right? So Ezekiel 38. And now, by the way, it goes all the way from 38 to 39. We're not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read starting in verse 7. I like what Jim McGuigan says about Gog and Magog. Gog is a grand illustration of any and all who oppose God's people. So Gog is a person who's opposing God's people, and Magog is a group or a force or some sort of organization that is opposing God's people. And they think they've got us, man. They've got us, man. It's over for us. I mean, Christianity is dead in Europe. It's over, and Islam is going to take over. You don't understand God. Verse 7. Get ready, be prepared. So this is God saying to the armies of Gog, he's saying, "Go after my people." Kind of like Satan, go after Job. We'll see what happens. All right. All the hordes gathered about you and take command of them. After many days, you'll be called to arms. In the future years, you'll invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel. Now, those who are reading Ezekiel, who do they think he's talking about? They think he's talking about Judah, which is going to be taken back after captivity to resettle the land. That's what they think. Is that what he's talking about? Yes. Is that the only thing he's talking about? No, he's not. All right. You and all your troops and the many nations with you will go up, advancing like a storm. You'll be like a cloud covering the land. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil scheme. You will say, I will invade the land of the unwalled villages. You're going to think it was your idea. But actually, it was God's idea. I will attack a peaceful and unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls and without gates and bars. I will plunder and loot and turn my hand against the resettled ruins and the people gathered from the nations, rich in livestock and goods, living in the center of the land. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish and all their villages will say to you, have you come to plunder? Have you gathered your hordes to loot, to carry off silver and gold, to take away livestock, goods, and to seize much plunder? Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. In that day when my people Israel are living in safety, will you not take notice of it? Will you not come from your place in the far north? You and your many nations with you, all of them riding on horses, a great horde, a mighty army. You will advance against my people Israel like a cloud that covers the land. In the days to come, Gog, I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I am proved holy through you before their eyes. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. You are the one I spoke of in former days by my servant, the prophet of Israel. At that time, they prophesied for years that I would bring you against them. This is what will happen in that day. When Gog attacks the land of Israel, my hot anger will be aroused, declares the Sovereign Lord. In my zeal and fiery wrath, I declare that at that time there will be great earthquakes in the land of Israel. Let me skip down here. All right, verse 1 of chapter 39. Son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I am against you, Gog, chief priest of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn you around. I will drag you along. I will bring you from the far north and send you against the mountains of Israel. Then I will strike your bow from your left hand and make your arrows drop from your right hand. On the mountain of Israel you will fall, you and all your troops and the nations with you. I will give you as food to all the carrion birds and to the wild animals. You will fall in the open field, for I have spoken, declares the Sovereign Lord. I will send fire on Magog and on those who live in safety in the coastlands, and they will know that I am the Lord. So God's people are living and they have no protection except God. And God is going to judge Gog and Magog. And it's going to be curtains for those guys. Okay, another motif, if you will, is the idea of the throne. And there are a lot of throne scenes in the Old Testament. The word throne appears, I think, something like 55 times in the book of Revelation. All right, it's constant, a throne theme. So I want to talk about a throne theme. So we have a number of throne scenes in Ezekiel. And again, please just get the picture. Okay, get the picture. Ezekiel 1 is, I would say, probably the most famous throne scene in the Old Testament. All right, it's too much to read, so I'll just read parts of it. You can read it all later. Starting in verse 4, I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north. By the way, why does it come out of the north in Ezekiel? Does anybody know?
Because that's where Assyria and Babylon.
Right. If you look on a map, here's Israel, here's Assyria and Babylon, so they're to the east, but they always go like this, and they always attack from the north. So he's talking about Babylon coming from the north. All right, but who's coming from the north in this image? It's actually God. All right, so God is the one directing these armies to attack. All right, to attack his people and to discipline them. It's kind of an intense image here. But that's similar to the imagery in Ezekiel 38, except in the case of Ezekiel 38, when they get there, he just flattens them. All right? But anyway, the center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was human, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like that of a calf, and gleamed like burnished bronze. Their feet were like that of a calf, and they burned, gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands. Under their wings, they had human hands. All four of them had faces and wings, and the wings of one touched the wings of another. Each of them went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. So you got one facing east, one facing west, one facing north, one facing south. They all start moving forward, and yet they stay stuck to each other. All right? So good luck taking this literally. All right, got it? Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had a face of a human being. On the right side of each had the face of a lion. On the left, the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. They each had two wings spreading out upward, each wing touching that of the creature on either side. And each had two other wings covering its body. Each of them went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go without turning as they went. The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire or torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. Those who know the book of Revelation, what chapter are we in right now? Glenn, you're not supposed to answer. Those who know the book of Revelation, what chapter are we in right now?
Four.
Right, we're in Revelation chapter 4. Correct answer. Nice job. Awesome. Let's skip down to verse 25. Then there came a voice from above the vault over their head. So we got the four creatures, right? These awesome creatures with I'm not going to interpret any of it because I'm going to let it sort of... When we get to Revelation 4, I'm going to tell you the different things, but I just want the picture. Then there came a voice from above the vault over their heads as they stood with lowered wings. Above the vault over the heads was one who looked like a throne of was what looked like a throne of lapis lazuli. And high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. And from there down, he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him, like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day. So was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Ezekiel chapter 9. Again, just get the picture. Verse 1 through 6. Then I heard him call out in a loud voice, "Bring near those who are appointed to execute judgment on the city, each with a weapon in his hand." By the way, this is both throne and judgment. Throne and judgment. Judgment is being declared from the throne room. And I saw six men coming from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. With them was a man clothed in linen who had a writing kit at his side. They came in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of the God of Israel went up from above the cherubim where it had been and moved to the threshold of the temple. Then the Lord called to the man clothed in linen who had a writing kit at his side and said to him, "Go throughout the city of Jerusalem and put a mark on the foreheads of those who grieve and lament over all the detestable things that are done in it." As I listened, he said to the others, "Follow him through the city and kill without showing pity or compassion. Slaughter the old men, the young women, and women, young men and women, mothers and children, but do not touch anyone who has the mark. Begin at my sanctuary." Notice that. Begin at my sanctuary. So they began with the old men who were in front of the temple. What chapter in Revelation are we in now? This time I'm going to let Glenn answer this question. Yeah, or 7, either 7 or 11. Because what's happening is God's people are being sealed for protection. Now, if you continue on in Ezekiel, you go to Ezekiel 14, you find out the fact that they were sealed. And what is that seal that protects them? What is that seal that protects us from destruction? It's the Holy Spirit. All right? And you find out later in Ezekiel that these guys who got sealed, a lot of them get killed. I thought they were getting protected. All right? And, you know, now they weren't getting protected from all the implications of the judgments that are coming. That's just the way it works. And then Ezekiel 10, 18 and 19, this is a really sad thing. Very sad for Israel. This will not happen in Revelation. Ezekiel 10, 18 and 19. Then the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple, and it stopped above the cherubim. While I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground. And as they went, the wheels went with them. They stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. So what's happened is God, in his mobile throne here, has moved from the temple, from the Holy of Holies to the threshold of the temple. That's not good. Then Ezekiel 11, 22 through 23, look what happens. It says, then the cherubim and the wheels beside them spread their wings, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. Then the glory of the Lord went up from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the exiles in Babylon, to the vision. So at this point, God left the temple behind completely. And it was like a shell. And by the way, Jesus came, the same hill that God went up, Jesus came down that hill when he entered into Jerusalem in great sort of symbolic form. All right, another throne scene. This is an interesting one, Ezekiel 43. By the way, Ezekiel 40 through 48 is the most boring part of the Bible. It is so boring. Do you really care whether the lintel is 3 cubits or 4 cubits? All right, but you have to understand it's about the throne room. And the throne room is a very holy place. Ezekiel 43. Again, just get a picture. Your job is to hold that picture in your mind as we read Revelation. All right, so Ezekiel 43, 1 through 11. Then the man brought me to the gate facing east, and I saw the glory of the Lord of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters. And the land was radiant with his glory. And the vision I saw was like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city back in Ezekiel chapter 9. And like the visions I had seen by the Kebar River, and I fell face down. The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. While the man was standing beside me, I heard someone speaking to me from inside the temple. He said, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place for the soles of my feet. This is where I will live among the Israelites forever. The people of Israel will never again defile my holy name. Neither they nor their kings, by their prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings at their death. When they placed their threshold next to my threshold and their doorpost beside my doorpost, with only a wall between me and them, they defiled my holy name by their detestable practices. So I destroyed them in my anger. Now let them put away for me their prostitution, etc., etc. Son of man, describe the temple to the people of Israel so they may be ashamed of their sin. Let them consider its perfection. And if they are ashamed of all they have done, make known to them the design of the temple. So the reason God goes into incredible, insane, ridiculous detail there in Ezekiel 40 through 48 is because he wants us to be ashamed. Because he wants us to see the perfection of his throne room and his temple and to realize we don't belong there. But the message is of Revelation is that that's exactly where we will be. All right, just a couple more throne scenes here. I don't know if I want to do all these. How am I doing here? All right, Zechariah 3. I love the throne stuff. It's pretty awesome stuff. Zechariah 3, just verse 1 through 5, so I can shorten it a bit. Then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord and Satan, standing at the right hand to accuse him. The Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this man a burning stick snatched from the fire?" Now Joshua was dressed in filthy clothes as he stood before the angel. The angel said to those who were standing before him, "Take off his filthy clothes." Then he said to Joshua, "See, I have taken away your sin. I will put fine garments on you." Then I said, "Put a clean turban on his head." And who wears a turban on their head? The priests wear the turban on their head. All right? And by the way, just, you know, we're now in Revelation chapter 12, just so you know. Zechariah 4. I'll leave off of Zechariah 4 because there's just too much stuff. Let's do Zechariah 6, verse 9. The word of the Lord came to me, "Take silver and gold from the exiles, Heldai, Tobijah, and Jedidiah, who have arrived from Babylon. Go the same day to the house of Judah, son of Zephaniah. Take the silver and gold and make a crown, and set it on the head of the high priest, Joshua, son of Jozadak. Tell him, 'This is what the Lord Almighty says. Here is the man whose name is Branch.'" And who's called Branch? Jesus. "And he will branch out from this place and will build the temple of the Lord. It is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he will be clothed with majesty and will sit and rule on his throne. And he will be a priest on his throne. And there will be harmony between the two, between the kingship and the priesthood." All right. Those are some throne scenes. How about some judgment scenes? Yeah. He's Jesus. That's, by the way, he's the high priest. Basically, what he's saying here is there's the king and there's the priest. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a priest. And how many priests ever had a crown? Zero. He says, "I'm going to take the priest and I'm going to make him a king on his throne."
And Jesus is the name Joshua.
Yeah, right. It's the same name. Right. So this is a vision of the throne room. And again, it's just a picture. I'm trying to get a picture. All right. I'm not going to go through Exodus 7 through 11. I just want you to picture it in your mind. Okay. Because again, judgment. The judgment that fell on Egypt, did that affect God's people? Did they?
Some of them did.
Yeah, like it turns out some of them did, and some of them didn't. Okay? Just think about the book of Revelation. Some of them definitely, absolutely affected everybody, including God's people. Some of them did not. Some of them were so intense and they affected other people and not Israel, like the darkness, right? It was all right, there you go. Again, it's just a picture. The thing is, this really happened. All right, Zechariah 6, 1 through 7. There are so many foreshadowings of judgment in the Old Testament. It could go on and on. I looked up, and again, there was before me four chariots coming from between two mountains, mountains of bronze. The first chariot had red horses, the second black, the third white, and the fourth dappled, all of them powerful. I asked the angel, "Who's speaking to me? What are these, my Lord?" The angel answered me, "These are the four spirits of heaven going out from standing in the presence of the Lord of the whole world. The one who is black is going towards the north, the one who is white towards the west, etc. When the powerful horses went out, they were straining to go throughout the earth. And he said, 'Go throughout the earth.' So they went throughout the earth. Then he called to me, 'Look, those going towards the north country have given my spirit rest in the land of the north.'" All right. And so what book in Revelation are we in right now? Revelation chapter 6. Correct. Last one. And then we'll take our next break. Joel 2, verse 1 through 5. Joel 2, verses 1 through 5. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk. Okay. Blow the trumpet in Zion. Sound the alarm on my holy hill. Let all who live in the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. By the way, the day of the Lord is this a very constant theme throughout the Old Testament, through the prophets. The day of the Lord is a day when the Lord comes. Is that a good day or a bad day? It depends. It depends on who you are. All right? But even those for whom it's a good day, it could be a good day and a bad day. It could be both at the same time. A day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, like dawn spreading across the mountains, a large and mighty army comes, such as never was in ancient times, nor ever will be in ages to come. Before them fire devours, behind them a flame blazes. Before them the land is like the Garden of Eden, behind them a desert, waste, nothing escapes them. They have the appearance of horses. They gallop along like cavalry. With noise like that of chariots, they leap over the mountains like a crackling fire, consuming stubble, like a mighty army drawn up for battle. At the sight of the nations are in anguish. Every face turns pale. They charge like warriors. They scale walls like soldiers. They all march in a line, not swerving from their course. They do not jostle each other. Each marches straight ahead. They plunge through defenses without breaking ranks. They rush upon the city. They run along the wall. They climb into the houses like thieves. They enter through the windows. Judgment is coming. What an encouraging way to end our session here. All right, so we're going to start the book of Revelation after our break. And our plan was to end the morning around 12:30. I think we're going to end closer to 12:15. That's great. Tomorrow we're going to end fairly early, sometime before 12, so that we can get back quick and Glenn can do his last lesson before he takes off. Okay, so 10-minute break. Then we'll start the book of Revelation.